they can't or won't adapt to military life. They have discipline problems, mental problems, situations like that. They're discharged. Not a dishonorable discharge, but something close to it.
You've got it right, Agent York, she says. Sheriff Williams picks up those fellows who have Rambo fantasies. When she gets them, they're upset, disappointed, ashamed. And the good sheriff offers them a gun, a uniform, and a good job, respect, and all that. She pays them well above the going rate from her cut of the various criminal enterprises that go on in the county. These losers get a second chance, and they will do anything for her, anything. Anything, York thinks. Anything. But how can she do that? How does she know how and where to get these soldiers? Peggy says, politics. How else? It's in her blood, it's in her family. The Williams family has been prominent in this county for more than 100 years, from Atlanta to Washington, she says. I was in her office a few days ago. I saw lots of photos up on the wall, her meeting with lots of politicians. But there was one black and white photo, some man in a suit, standing on the Capitol steps. Peggy nods. Her great-uncle, Whitney Wilson Williams, United States Senator, served 2 glorious terms back in the 1950s. His great-niece Emma always wanted to go to Washington, but her one try for Congress 6 years ago finished with her in 3rd place. Sheriff Williams doesn't like losing, but she knows the facts. She can't go to D.C. on her own. York says, I saw her the other night at a campaign rally for, what's his name again? Conover, she says. Mason Conover. A dim bulb among our congressional delegation, which means he'll go far when he's elected senator next week. And rumor has it that Sheriff Williams is on tap to be his chief of staff once he moves to better quarters. But her background here, I mean, Peggy says, damn it, Roscoe, how can you get heavier by just sitting here? She picks up the cat and gently puts him on the floor. Oh, who's going to investigate her, me? The Washington Post? Nope. She has a clear path to Washington where she's always wanted to be, which would be nice for me and this county, not having her looking over us day after day, like some bloodthirsty medieval queen. York just stares at this older woman's calm and nearly relaxed face. Peggy says, Why, she told me last year she planned to get to D.C. no matter how many bodies she had to step on along the way. Chapter 67. The Honorable Emma Williams, Sheriff of Sullivan County in the state of Georgia, strides through the crowded interior of Babe's Breakfast in Tanner, a town in the western area of her county, smiling and nodding to its customers, either sitting at the counter or in booths until she gets to the last booth in the row and sits down. Across from her this early Wednesday morning is a surprised Cornelius Slate, district attorney, a full breakfast plate of scrambled eggs, toast, grits, and sausage links in front of him. Hey, Corny, she says, knowing just how much he hates the nickname. Fancy me finding you here. A heavy-set waitress in a stained pink uniform comes over, and before she can say anything, Williams holds up a hand. Ah, just coffee, black, and put it on Corny's tab, I'm sure he won't mind. The waitress shuffles away and Williams takes off her campaign-style hat, puts it on the padded seat next to her and says, You know, Corny, I don't know how anyone can start a day with something so filling and heavy. I put away a breakfast like that, I'd be snoozing for half a day. Slate doesn't say anything, but his face is ashen, and Williams says, But if something is in front of me, I can't stand the temptation. Excuse me. Williams picks up a sausage link, takes a healthy bite. Yum, boy, this is something, isn't it? Sure doesn't taste like one of those tofu or turkey sausages. It's the real deal. Slate says, She finishes the sausage link, picks up another one from Slate's breakfast plate, and takes another pleasing bite. Corny, just what in the hell are you up to?
My job, Sheriff. You know how it is.
She shakes her head.
No, I don't know how it is. What I do know is that you went behind my back last night and made some sort of criminal plea deal with that Sergeant Jefferson. Corny, why in hell did you do that without clearing it with me?
The flush on his face deepens.
Ah, Sheriff, with all due respect, I am the senior law enforcement officer in this county. I really don't have to, clear anything with you.
She eyes him coldly as she chews on the sausage link. Slate stays quiet. Williams reaches out and takes the last link off his plate.
Corney, with all due respect, do I really need to reaffirm the facts of life for you?
Do I? Remind you of the times my boys drove you home from the American Legion or the trackside roadhouse when you had too much to drink? Or the time your nephew Bobby Tim beat the crap out of his wife, a real embarrassing mess for you, and I took care of it? Or other times we helped out your office in finding last-minute evidence that let you prosecute cases that were dead-enders?
Slate picks up a fork full of scrambled eggs, changes his mind, puts the fork back down on his plate.
Ah, that's all in the past now, isn't it? Truth is, I don't have to clear anything with you now, Sheriff. What happened is the staff sergeant agreed to plead guilty at the hearing tomorrow. That gets the case out of here, saves time and money for the county. Everybody wins.
Williams takes her time chewing the last of his sausage link.
Win? What kind of win is that? Those two other rangers go free.
But you know there's no forensic evidence linking them to the crimes. It all goes back to the staff sergeant. He's taking the blame and it's still a win.
She chews some more.
I don't see it that way.
Well, I do, Sheriff.
You know what I see? I see you up for re-election next Tuesday, running against that Falconer fella, and you want to crush him.
You had the votes, Corny, to win, but that wasn't enough.
You want to go into Tuesday's election with this high-profile case behind you. The case of the Summerhouse murders. Impress the voters, make it a landslide instead of a decent win, make up for all your shortcomings.
Slate lowers his eyes.
William says,
Hell, it's not a bad strategy, Corny, but you should have cleared it with me first. You know it, and I know it. But you had to go rogue, go off the reservation, and I can't, and won't, stand for that. Pretty soon I'll have to square accounts with you, and I'll warn you, it won't be pretty.
He lifts his eyes, looking defiant.
How's that, Sheriff? Word we get is that when Mason gets elected to the Senate, he's taking you along to Washington. Good for you. You're heading out, going to your dream job and place of residence. That means those of us back here, we're on our own. We need to look out for ourselves, that's the truth.
She picks up a napkin, wipes the grease off her fingers. The truth is the truth, and she has hitched her hopes and dreams to Representative Mason Conover, doing what it takes to get him elected to the Senate, even putting up with his whiny phone calls these past few days. But why admit it to this clown?
Aw, hell, Corny, what makes you think that? Sure, I might be leaving Sullivan County if the congressman wants me to come along after he wins, but I intend to keep my organization in place, humming along, even with me gone.
Deputy Lindsay, he'll be taking my place, just you wait and see. Slate's eyes widen.
That boy Clark Lindsay? Are you kidding? He's the one who shot and killed Mrs. Gendron's dog.
The dog charged him.
The dog was blind, Slate says.
Still, it should have known better,
Williams says, tossing the used napkin on the district attorney's plate.
Thing is, Corny, if everybody knew their place and stayed in their place, it'd be a better world.
The waitress from earlier comes over, puts down a white mug of coffee. Williams picks up the coffee cup, gently blows across it.
Ah, she says, taking a sip. Nice and black. Just like our souls, Corny.
Chapter 68. Afghanistan.
My not-so-great escape ends with me coming up against a smooth concrete wall. Maybe a blast barrier or something separating this part of the compound from another set of buildings. I turn and two male corporals in standard ACUs and carrying holstered pistols approach me, wearing patrol caps and very serious looks on their faces.
Major Cook? The one on the left asks.
Yes, that's me, I say, returning their salutes, feeling tired, defeated, and just worn out. All the way here and to be picked up in a narrow alley by two MPs, no doubt dispatched from Quantico, way on the other side of the world. Mission definitely not accomplished. I'm in deep trouble.
and with the pain and the exhaustion coursing through me, I also feel shame that I'm letting down not only my investigative squad, but also the three imprisoned rangers. The one on the left says, "Sir, would you come with us, please?" The other one steps forward, holds out a hand. "I'll take your rucksack, sir." Then I notice the special skill tab on the soldier's shoulder. Ranger. We're traveling on one of the access roads paralleling the main Bagram runway when the corporal driving says, "Sir?" I'm sitting in the rear of the uncomfortable Humvee, my muscle memory roaring back, reminding me of a previous ride in a Humvee and how it nearly killed me, and, "Yes?" "Do me a favor, sir, huddle over and pretend you're napping, okay?" "Why?" "Because there's a checkpoint up ahead, I think they might be looking for you, and I got my orders." "Shit," I think, and I lower my cap and hunch over to my right like I'm resting against my rucksack. The Humvee slows, the front door opens, some voices. I try to ease my breathing like I'm really asleep instead of being moments away from being arrested for a variety of charges. The door is shut. The Humvee resumes its motion. The corporal says, "Boy, the MPs sure are stirred up about an army major named Cook who smuggled himself into this shithole. Lucky for me, I didn't spot your name tag back there." I slowly sit up. Some luck. A few minutes after the checkpoint, I'm in a cluttered cubicle made of plywood in a secure area near the runway. The sounds of jets ticking off and landing and the deep thump-thump of helicopters roaring overhead is constant. And before me is an Army Ranger captain talking to someone on a phone. The plywood walls are covered with maps, calendars, charts, and a Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders poster. The captain says, yes, ma'am, I understand, ma'am." He suddenly stands up, a frown on his weathered face, and says, "This call is for you, Major. Excuse me while I step out." I take the phone and wait until the captain leaves the cubicle. A thin, squeaky wooden door closing behind him, and I say, "This is Major Cook." A strong woman's voice comes across the phone line. "This is Major Frederico West, Special Troops Battalion, 75th Ranger Regiment out of Fort Benning. We need to talk." I feel like a wide-eyed young rookie out on his first real street patrol back in the NYPD, facing real trouble for the first time. "Major, about what?" "I don't want to do it over the phone," she says. "Has to be face-to-face." "Here?" I ask as an overhead helicopter makes the plywood walls shake. "Hell no," she says. "Where I am, at an FOB near Kost, close to a village called Pendahar. Interested in seeing me now?" "Very much so," I say. "But Major, how did you... I mean..." Her voice is filled with steel and determination. "I'm with the battalion's military intelligence company, and one bit of interesting intelligence has come my way in the last 12 hours. You know Major Frank Moore?" Instantly I reply, remembering the pleasant man I met a few days ago with Connie, before going up before the 4th Battalion's colonel. "Certainly, the executive officer for the 4th Battalion." "That's right," she says. "His body was pulled from the Savannah River last night, local time, with a bullet to the forehead. It looks like he was murdered right after an unauthorized visit to Staff Sergeant Caleb Jefferson over in Ralston in Sullivan County."
"Damn," I think.
Her voice changes in tone. "Major, do you remember a specialist from the 82nd Airborne named Connor? Brad Connor? He was charged with stealing a crate of 7.62mm ammunition and selling it to a gang in Charlotte." The name pops up in my memory and I say yes, nearly 3 years back. "Right, your investigation cleared him."
"Well, Major, my investigation went to the evidence, that's what cleared him."
She says, "That's your point of view. You knew that Specialist Connor's dad was an Army Ranger, correct?"
"Well, yes, I did learn that during the course of my investigation, but that's about it. It didn't matter."
The major on the other end of the line says, "Well, it matters to us. His father is Trent Connor, former command sergeant major at the Ranger Training Brigade at Fort Benning, and prior to that, well, I don't have the time to tell you his service record and list of awards and decorations. Let's just say Command Sergeant Major Connor is a goddamn legend in the Ranger community, and you earned a solid helping out his son."
I know this is an exaggeration, but I'm not going to correct the Major. She adds,
So let's you and me get together to figure out what the hell is going on with 4th Battalion and that damn ninja squad.
I say, yes, let's. Chapter 69. Even though it's his day off, Dwight Dix of the Sullivan County Sheriff's Department, known to family and friends as Dee-Dee, is not having a good morning. He pulled an unexpected late shift last night on direct orders from Sheriff Emma, and he's still humiliated by how he was chased away by that slick spick who fooled Dee-Dee into thinking he had a pistol in his hand. He paces back and forth in the small kitchen of his double-wide, barefoot, wearing blue jeans and nothing else, drinking a cold cup of coffee. Out in the living room with the orange shag carpeting that stinks because his wife Penny's two cats keep on pissing there, his son Morris and daughter Tina are yowling and tussling over some broken plastic toys.
Penny!
He calls out to his wife. Will you tell those two to settle down? Penny murmurs, tell them yourself, and goes back to her late morning, hell, her now daily routine, of lying on the couch with the scuffed and worn cushions, watching one of those damn chick chat shows on TV, balancing a bowl of cheddar snack crackers on her swelling stomach where their third child is coming along. Dee Dee pours the cold coffee down the sink and stares out the grease-stained kitchen window. He doesn't belong here. He's never belonged here. But after he was dismissed during his first deployment for some crazy reason due to his temper, he found himself working as a fry cook outside Savannah before Sheriff Emma recruited him. It was a sweet gig when it started. Nice pay, bennies, and for once his temper was seen as an asset instead of a liability. But now it's different. Oh, he doesn't mind doing shit for the greater good, like tuning up suspects or planting crystal meth in some toad's pickup truck, making it easier for the district attorney to get a conviction. But the stuff he did and saw in the summer house, the shooting, the screaming, and that poor baby girl, why her? He shakes his head. Enough is enough. It's time to man up and get a deal. Get the hell out of here and bring along Penny and the kids. And if she doesn't want to move her fat ass off the couch to go with him, well, he'll figure it out. Dee Dee ducks into the bedroom, past piles of clothes, socks, and panties on the floor, and quickly gets dressed. He grabs the keys to his truck from an ashtray loaded with old coins and paper clips and heads back out to the kitchen.
Where are you going, Dee Dee?
Penny asks. Out, he says, tugging on a pair of sneakers.
Why? 'Cause I got to. Gotta do what?
He doesn't even look back at her when he heads to the door.
Out to finally make things right.
Penny Dix waits until she hears Dee Dee's truck roar out of the trailer park and then picks up the bowl of snack crackers, puts it on the cluttered coffee table, and with an oomph and a heavy sigh, gets off the couch. She moves into the kitchen and takes her cell phone out of her purse and makes a call.
Sullivan County Dispatch, what's the nature of your emergency?
I need to speak to Sheriff Williams.
The snotty-sounding woman says,
she's in a meeting and can't be disturbed.
Her bratty kids are screaming again, and Penny sticks a finger in one ear so she can hear better.
Look, Missy, this here is her cousin Penny calling, and I need to talk to Sheriff Emma right now.
The woman says nothing. The line goes quiet. A click and a reassuring voice comes on the line.
Hey, Penny, hon, what's going on? Sheriff Emma. It's Dee Dee.
The reply is quick. What's wrong?
I don't know, she says. Something's been bothering him these past few days. He's been using the chaw more than he does, drinking more, and at night he gets these awful dreams. And right now he left the house without even much saying goodbye.
Her cousin says,
did he say what was wrong or where he was going?
Penny hesitates. She never got good grades in school, not ever, but she's not stupid. She knows how Sheriff Emma runs the county and knows Dee Dee has to do some things that others would refuse. But if Dee Dee is in some kind of trouble, why wouldn't Sheriff Emma help?
Sheriff, he said he was off finally to make things right, something like that. Do you know what it means? Is it important?
Even with the TV on and the damn kids screaming, she can hear her cousin just breathing on the phone.
Emma, did I do right calling you?
And before the call is disconnected, the cold voice of her cousin says,
Penny, you have no idea.
Chapter 70. Special Agent Connie York is desperately trying to keep her yawning under control, but based on last night and the previous nights, it's a damn losing battle. Her worn and dented rental Ford is parked at the end of a dirt road, and the other two Fords are parked a few feet away. Huang and Pierce arrived just a few minutes earlier with their late breakfasts, plastic-wrapped donuts, coffee, and orange juice in plastic containers, all purchased a while ago from a convenience store in Chatham County. Sanchez says, "You sure you two weren't followed?" Pierce takes the lid off his coffee. "Look up the road. You see a cruiser coming down?" Huang joins in. "Maybe there's a black helicopter coming." "Shut up," Sanchez says. York says, "All of you, knock it off." Cold quiet comes to the group. York feels like a failure. All of them slept in the three cars overnight, though it wasn't much of a sleep. Tired, achy, and facing a day of... what? What to do? Major Cook ordered her to push the investigation, but what was left to push? The dog-walking witness is missing, and so is the owner of the convenience store. The murder house and whatever evidence inside is a pile of burnt rubble. Staff Sergeant Caleb Jefferson has cut a deal to plead guilty and is about to make it permanent at tomorrow's court hearing. And oh yeah, the sheriff is corrupt and a criminal to boot, and her deputies are following them wherever they go. Sanchez says, "You haven't heard from the major, right?" York says, "I've tried twice, no answer." "You sure you're using the sat phone, right? Agent York?" Just before she's about to use her voice to tear off that arrogant cop's head, her phone rings. Her cell phone, not the Iridium satellite phone. She digs into her bag, pulls it out. Broderick, CID, Quantico. York lets the call go to voicemail, like she's done three times prior. Huang asks, "Colonel Broderick, ma'am?" "The one and only," she says. Sanchez says, "One of these days you're going to have to answer." "Maybe I'll give the call to you, Agent Sanchez." Sanchez looks like he's going to say something when the phone rings again. Pierce says, "The colonel's being persistent this morning." York is about to say the same thing when she sees her screen. Blocked call. She steps away and answers the phone. "Hello?" An unfamiliar man's voice.
"Is this the army cop?"
"Excuse me?"
"I said, is this the army cop? The one looking into the summer house killings? The one the Army Ranger's been charged with?"
"I am," she says. "I'm Special Agent York of the Army CID. Who's this?"
"Someone who knows what really happened that night, lady. Someone who wants to let you know."
"Why?"
"'Cause I was there. And I helped. And it made me sick," the man says, his voice quivering. "I want to make it right. I want to talk to you, lady. Confess it all. Get a deal and get the hell out of this county."
"How did you get my number?"
"Peggy Reese, that bitch reporter, but I made a deal. She gave me your number and I promised to give her the whole story a day later, give you folks enough time to do your job."
Some of her crew are whispering and York takes a few steps farther away. "How do I know you're for real, that you're not just making it up?" The man sighs.
"I'll tell you something that's not in the papers. How's that? Up on the second floor of the house, right side bedroom, older lady was drug out from under a bed."
York says,
"Okay, that's a start."
"Oh, then how about this then? The bedroom across the hall where there were three dead folks. A guy in the bed with bandages on his arms. A chunky woman on the floor and a poor dead little girl right there. Like her mama was trying to protect her."
The air around her suddenly feels chilled. York says, "I need to see you right now. Where?"
The man says, "Shit, not in this county. There's a Waffle House across the North County line on Gateway Boulevard West, just off Route 204, on the way into Savannah. I'll see you there in 90 minutes. How's that?"
"That sounds fine," she says. "How will I know you?"
The man says,
"I'll be the scared son of a bitch sitting by himself at the far end. And you, lady, you come by yourself, okay? I'll make sure I'm sitting near an exit door, and if you come by with anybody else, I'm out of there."
He disconnects the call. York walks back to her crew, tells them what's just happened. Not surprisingly, Sanchez makes a fuss.
"Damn it, York, this whole county is wrapped up and under the sheriff's thumb, and you're going off to meet some clown who said he was there?"
"He told me things that haven't been made public."
"Sure," Sanchez says. "And if the sheriff is in on whatever happened, then she might have fed this guy this info, set you up, get you going to that Waffle House and arrest you for crossing a double yellow line. You could end up in the county jail and never come out."
Good point, she says, which is why you're going to be in charge when I'm gone, Sanchez, so the investigation continues. You're going to protect those three surviving Rangers. Make sure nothing happens to them until we hear something from the Major. Got it?
Sanchez finally nods, and Huang and Pierce both say, Yes, ma'am. York nods too.
Good. Now transfer your gear from that rental. I've got places to go, and sorry to say, I'm not driving the one with the dented hood. Based on our luck, the damn thing will pop off about halfway there.
20 minutes later, York pulls over for a quick moment, reaches into her bag, comes out with her Sig Sauer. There's a round in the chamber, of course, but she wants to make sure she has two spare clips nearby when she goes into the Waffle House. If it is a trap, she's going to be ready. Chapter 71, Afghanistan. I'm in temporary quarters for the night, waiting for a convoy to leave Bagram at 5 a.m. tomorrow, heading south to Khost to meet up with Major Frederica West. Earlier she said, these are supposed to be secure phone lines, but we're not taking any chances. I'll set up transport for you. See you late tomorrow morning, Major. Safe travels. Stay low. The quarters are an old concrete block building subdivided into small plywood cubicles. I've had a dinner at the local DFAC and a quick wash-up, and I've stretched out on a borrowed sleeping bag with a wool blanket over me. A small lamp on a stand is next to the bed, and close by is my trusted Bruce Catton book, along with my Iridium satellite phone. I grab the phone, power it up, dial the digits. Ring, 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 no answer. Ring, 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 still no answer. Where's York? What's she doing? How's the rest of the crew? And the investigation there in Sullivan? I shut the Iridium down, restart it, and then dial the numbers once more. Ring. A crackle of static, and I sit up straight, ignoring the bolt of pain that shoots right through my leg and into my skull.
Major? Comes York's voice. Are you all right?
Her voice is fading in and out, and I go right to the condensed version of what I've been doing. I'm fine, I say. I'm in Bagram, heading off to Pendahar tomorrow. Look, remember Major Frank Moore, the XO of 4th Battalion? Got word from a ranger officer here that he was murdered after visiting Staff Sergeant Jefferson. Bullet wound to the head, pulled out of the Savannah River.
Damn, York says. Major, things are also moving quickly over here. Witnesses have disappeared. The murder house was burned down, and it looks like Sheriff Williams is running the county as her own personal criminal enterprise.
Now it's my turn to swear. York goes on, her voice strong and in charge.
That's not all. Staff Sergeant Jefferson's cut a deal with the district attorney. He's...
Her voice fades out, and there's a hiss of static, and her voice comes back and says,
So there's that.
I raise my voice.
That's what?
Her voice cuts through.
He's pleading guilty. In exchange for pleading guilty, the district attorney is cutting the other two rangers loose.
More static, and she says,
Hold on, making a turn now.
A turn? Where are you? A nervous laugh.
On my way to a Waffle House for a very late breakfast, with a witness who says he was at the shooting. Sorry, Major, I think we're going to break this case stateside.
I rub at my aching leg. Who's the witness?
Don't know.
Is Sanchez with you? Her voice fades out again.
Alone.
York, don't you dare go there without backup, I yell. I want Sanchez with you! There's silence. Not even a whisper of static. I admire York, I trust York, and I'd love to see York in a bikini. But Sanchez has a more down-and-dirty outlook about humanity, having worked some very mean streets in L.A. when he was a cop. If York is off to meet somebody claiming to be a witness at a Waffle House, I want Sanchez sitting in a nearby booth with a cut-down AR-15 across his lap. York! I yell. One more hiss of static, and her voice fading out.
I'll be okay, Major.
Then the call is disconnected. For the next half hour, I try again to call Connie, and none of the calls go through. I finally stop when someone in the adjacent cubicle pounds the thin plywood and yells, Hey, some of us trying to sleep over here. Knock that shit off. I turn the light off, stretch out, and I don't go to sleep. Not at all. York seems to be right. The case is breaking open in Georgia, and here I am, alone and clueless, stuck in Afghanistan. Chapter 72.
Special Agent Connie York spots the familiar shape and logo of the Waffle House just off Route 204 leading into Savannah, and she has a tinge of anticipation, knowing that the airport she arrived at a few long days ago is just a quick drive away. It'll be wonderful, she thinks, to get this damn thing wrapped up, get back on a Silverbird, and get the hell out of Georgia. She parks beside the bright yellow and red building with its black lettering and gets out of her car, thinking of an article she read once that said FEMA had a Waffle House Index with which it determined how damaged a community was after a hurricane or tornado passed through it. The sooner the local Waffle House opens after a natural disaster, the quicker a local community would recover. York opens the door and steps in, wondering what kind of index the CID could establish if she broke this case in the next several minutes at this particular Waffle House. The interior is like every other Waffle House she's been in, with bright lights, a counter, and booths with red cushions. There's a good mix of customers here at midday, locals and workers, and in the last booth, sitting by himself, is a nervous-looking male who nods at her as she approaches. He's in his late 20s, light brown hair buzzed short, with deep blue eyes that are flickering around like old memories are haunting him. He has on blue jeans and a soiled white t-shirt that is tight against his torso and bulky upper biceps. York steps up to him and says, "Let's change seats." "Huh?" She takes her soft leather bag off her shoulder, gestures with her free hand. "Move around. I don't know you. I don't know where you're from. All I know is that you told me you have knowledge about a mass killing that took place less than a week ago. Move it. I want my back against the wall." The guy gets up and does just that, and she thinks, good, score one for the team. Him moving shows he is malleable, weak, and she will use that to her advantage. When he is settled, she sits down, content with knowing that from this last row of booths, she has a good view of the restaurant's interior. A young blonde waitress comes over and drops off the multicolored menus, and Connie barely gives the menu a glance as she looks closer at the man across from her with his muscles and close-cropped hair. Something comes to her. A gamble, but what the hell? "What unit were you in before being discharged?" York asks. "And how long have you been working for Sheriff Williams?" Her questions seem to stun him, because he stares, nods, and says, "How do you know?" "We know a lot more than you think," York says. "Answer the question, starting with your name." He clasps his hands in front of him on the clean table. "Dwight Dix. Before I became a deputy in Sullivan County, I was in the 10th Mountain Division out of Fort Drum. Did part of a tour overseas in Afghanistan before." Dix seems ashamed, and York won't push it, not now. "Something happened. You were discharged at loose ends, and Sheriff Emma Williams offered you a job, right?" A quick nod. "That's right." She takes out a white legal pad and pen, sets them before her. "Very well, then, Dwight. You told me you had information about those killings. I believe you. You gave me details only someone who was there or intimately involved would know. What happened?" Dick shakes his head. "Nope, we're not gonna do it this way." York feels tense. Part of her wanting to grab this fool by his t-shirt neck and slam his thick head onto the table. "You had something to do with a 2-year-old girl being killed." She takes a breath. "What way is that, Dwight?" He taps her legal pad. "I want you to write something legal for me. About immunity. About me telling you what happened that night at the summer house and who did the shooting and why. I get that piece of paper promising not to prosecute, and then I'll talk." York keeps her voice even. "You like watching those Law and Order marathons on TV, is that it?" "Huh?" She says, "Dwight, I'm a law enforcement officer with the U.S. Army. I don't have any pull with county or state law enforcement and not much with federal law enforcement." His face falls and she adds, "I mean, I could write something up like that, but it wouldn't be legal. It would be a lie, and that's not how I operate. Understand?" "But I need something." York uncaps her pen. "This is the best I can do, Dwight," York says. "I'll write out a statement and sign it with my name, rank, and service number, and—" "How about your badge number?" he interrupts. "CID agents don't have badge numbers," she says.
I'll make a statement saying that in my professional opinion you have expressed remorse and have offered invaluable investigative assistance, and that in any future dealings with state or federal law enforcement, I will be speaking up on your behalf to protect your legal interests. As she narrates this to Dwight, she writes down the words, and she signs them with a flourish. After tearing off the sheet, she passes it over to Dwight, keeping her face calm and impassive, because that piece of paper is total and utter legal bullshit. But he bites. He folds it up and puts it in his pocket.
Okay, what do you want to know?
Were you there the night of the killings?
Yes,
he says. Who ordered them to take place?
Deputy Clark Lindsay, but I'm sure Sheriff Emma was behind it. Hell, nobody in the sheriff's department can take a crap without her say-so.
Who was there?
Me, Clark, and Teddy Collins.
Why did you do it?
He shrugs. We did our jobs. We were told that in this house was a bunch of low-life drug dealers that had skated over and over again on various charges. We were told to clear the place out. Clark said not to worry, these guys had competitors. It'd eventually be pinned on some rival drug gang.
York again thinks of 2-year-old Polly Zachary.
Did you shoot that little girl? Shit, no!
He says, raising his voice, causing some customers in the nearby booth to turn their heads and look at him.
There were 2 guys sitting on a couch. I took them out, Clark and Teddy. They took care of the rest. The girl downstairs and the folks upstairs.
But the Rangers were arrested 2 nights later, she says. You're telling me they weren't involved? Another shake of the head.
Nope.
But there was evidence from the scene, fingerprints, shell casings. Dwight says, I heard later from Clark that the Rangers were there about an hour or so before we got there. That'll take care of the fingerprints, I guess. And Clark, he's got another job working as a civilian attendant at the shooting range at Hunter. I bet he could get some empty shell casings from a certain Ranger's pistol if he had to. York is writing so hard and fast that she is sure the pen is close to shredding the paper. She has a memory of once working on a computer jigsaw puzzle, with none of the 128 pieces fitting, until she used the help feature of the program and reduced the number of puzzle pieces to 24. Then the puzzle was solved within seconds. This deputy, this disgraced soldier, this killer sitting so calmly across from her, he is her own help feature. Damn, won't the major be happy when she calls him later?
But here's the big question, Dwight, she says. Why? What was the real reason to frame the Rangers for those killings? What was it?
He seems to be wrestling with something, and she says, Dwight, what I signed there, I'm behind it 100%. I won't let you be by yourself, I promise. The man squeezes his hands together.
It had something to do with Afghanistan when they were there.
Afghanistan, she thinks, just like Major Cook thought.
Dwight, she says, tell me.
In the parking lot of the Waffle House, Beau Layton carefully parks the stolen Honda Accord that he and his cousin Ricky lifted a few minutes ago, after they had tailed the guy earlier from Sullivan. Lesson he learned a long time ago is that if you need wheels, get something dull-looking and ordinary that doesn't stand out and then use it quick, before the owner makes the call the stolen car is sent out over the wires. He and Ricky are both wearing black wrestling sneakers, loose khaki pants, and short black hoodies. Each has a ski mask on his head, ready to be pulled down in the next 30 seconds when they start dancing. Bo switches off the engine, leaving the keys in the ignition. He says,
you ready?
His cousin says,
damn it, now that I'm here, I'm kind of hungry. Why can't we get something to eat and then do the job?
Bo feels the usual frustration bubble to the surface. His cousin has dead aim with a gun and is quick with his fists and boots, but most times he fails to see the larger picture. Like the time when he was first picked up on an adult charge that got reduced, and he was on work release with 2 weeks left on his sentence, and he left a county lawn mowing job to get a beer at a nearby tavern. In doing so, he got an extra 12 months tacked on for attempted escape. And why? I was thirsty for a beer, he said. Bo swivels in his seat and picks up a black gym bag, unzips it, and hands over a Desert Eagle 45 semi-automatic pistol.
Because we were told by Sheriff Emma that the job has to be done now, as soon as possible. Funny thing that we're about to do that deputy because of his boss.
Ricky works the action of the Desert Eagle, sits up, and slides it into his waistband. Bo does the same with his.
Don't worry, he'll get a nice cop funeral, make his family so proud.
Before Bo opens the door, Ricky says,
What happens if some other cop or do-gooder gets in the way?
Bo says, Kill them all. Chapter 73. The deputy before York is about to speak when two men burst through the door at the far end, wearing ski masks over their heads and brandishing pistols. One yells out, Nobody moves! This is a goddamn robbery! York instantly thinks, No, no, it isn't. She doesn't believe in coincidences, and lowers her right hand to her open bag to grab her Sig Sauer. She says, Stay put, Dwight, stay put. But Dwight's flipped his head around, spots the two men. Shit, he says. The first gunman is pointing his pistol at the cashier, making her put cash into a small green plastic bag. The nearer gunman is slowly walking down the center aisle. He yells out, Hands on the table, now! Hands where I can see them! Some whispers and words from the customers as they all follow the shouted directions, and the gunman says, Freeze! I want everybody to stay put! We'll be out of here in a minute! York doesn't believe him. She quickly grabs a napkin, covers her right hand with it, and in a moment has both hands on the table, the napkin concealing her pistol. In a low voice, she says, Dwight, slide under the table now. With the man at the other end focusing on getting the money, a cover for what they're actually here for, York has no doubt, the approaching gunman is looking at each customer as he comes down the aisle. But the mask is screwing up his peripheral vision. They have a few seconds of grace. Dwight, she says again, slide under the table. But Dwight says, Screw this. He jumps up from the booth, runs to the door marked exit, and York pulls her gun hand free as the nearest gunman says, Gotcha, Dwight! He fires twice, and York fires just as quickly. Screams, shouts. Dwight collapses against the closed door, his white t-shirt torn and bloody, and York stands up, both hands on her pistol, and approaches the gunman sprawled out on the floor as his companion whirls and dives out the front door.
Federal agent, she yells. Everybody stay where you are!
Screams, shouts, dishes falling to the floor and breaking. She gets closer to the gunman, looks down at him, then quickly glances around at the frightened customers, making sure there isn't a third gunman hidden out there. York points to a bearded man with a John Deere cap and yells,
You! Call 911!
The gunman has three wounds right in the center of his chest, and his legs are crumpled underneath him, like all the muscles and ligaments have turned to jelly. His pistol is on the floor. A young boy in a nearby booth turns around and reaches to pick it up. York yells, Kid, no, don't touch the gun! And the second gunman comes back in the front door. York lifts up her pistol. A gunshot and a hammering blow to her head. Darkness. Chapter 74. Special Agent Manuel Sanchez is on his way to the Ralston jail, the other Ford behind him. Pierce driving, Doc Huang sitting next to him. After York left for her trip to the Waffle House, how in hell can anybody seriously eat at a place that sounds like it belongs in a Disney park, Sanchez thinks. They went back to the convenience store to see if they could get the current manager to say anything more about the indictment that's put the store in danger. But the manager they talked to last had been replaced by a gracious woman with about a half dozen English words in her vocabulary. Another visit to the funeral home revealed the director is gone on an unexpected trip to Atlanta, and District Attorney Cornelius Slate is in the middle of a trial and can't be disturbed. The sky is overcast, and Sanchez feels, yeah, a big-ass storm is coming, and everyone's heading for the hills. Sanchez is in a hurry, but he's keeping his speed right below the limit. No use giving Sheriff Williams and her criminal gang an opportunity to pull them over for speeding. He did the same back in L.A. as a cop when looking for any excuse to... The other Ford is flashing its lights, honking its horn, and his phone starts ringing. Damn it, he thinks. Something must be up. He pulls over the Ford, braking hard, tossing up a cloud of dust from the side of the road. Around them are nothing but trees, fields, barbed wire, and skinny cows. Sanchez gets out as Huang and Pierce come over to him, both looking worried. Give, he says. The dust settles. Huang gives him his phone, set to the home page of an Atlanta TV station. Two killed, one seriously wounded at Waffle House robbery. Sanchez tries to scroll through the screen, but he does it wrong and a goddamn weather app shows up. Pierce wipes at his forehead.
They're not identifying the two dead, the JAG lawyer says, but the seriously wounded is a woman. We've been calling Connie's cell ever since the story broke. No answer.
What now? Huang says. Manny, what do we do now?
Sanchez gives the smartphone back to Pierce. I'm heading to Savannah. You find out what hospital York's been taken to, let me know. If she learned anything before the sons of bitches started shooting, I want to find out.
And what about us? Pierce asks.
Sanchez walks back to his rental. You two stay on the job. Get to the Ralston jail and... He stops. Their original goal was to try to see the Rangers again, to find out why in hell the staff sergeant is planning to plead guilty tomorrow. But the ambush of York changes everything. Sanchez quickly walks back.
You two get to the jail. I don't know how you're going to do it, but you're going to protect those three Rangers, got it? All the witnesses in this county are gone, and now they're going after us. The Rangers are next. Get to the jail. Do what it takes to protect them.
Pierce says,
how?
Figure it out.
From Huang.
But what? Sanchez says. We've got no time.
Huang looks at Pierce.
We're a lawyer and a doctor, that's all. How can we do this?
Sanchez says, you're wrong, Doc. You're both armed officers of the United States Army. Act like it. Then he heads back to the rental and after his first two steps, starts running.
Chapter 75. Sheriff Emma Williams is having her photo taken with a crew of young volunteers for the Conover for Senate campaign late that Wednesday afternoon, when the day's burner phone starts vibrating in her right-hand trousers pocket. She keeps her smile frozen in place as the photographer for the Sullivan County Times, a young pimply boy who's taking himself way too seriously, maneuvers the young boys back and forth, making sure their handmade cardboard signs are held up at the correct angle. Kids for Conover, they say, and there are also a few of her own, re-elect Sheriff Williams in the mix. As her cell phone continues to vibrate, Williams wants to shout to the photographer in this Baptist church hall in Sanders, a small town at the western end of the county, move your skinny ass. But that would earn the wrath of all assembled here, she's sure. For God's wrath, well, he hadn't sent a lightning bolt yet to scorch her butt, so either he's ignoring her or he doesn't exist. Finally, the young boy in a t-shirt and long shorts that go below his knees lifts his camera to his face, and after a quick series of click, 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 he says, now y'all stay in place so I can get your name straight, okay? The kids seem excited that their photo will end up in the paper, and Williams squeezes the shoulder of an older woman volunteer and says,
do you mind? I have to take a phone call.
The woman smiles and points.
If you need some privacy, the food bank pantry is right over there, Sheriff.
Williams nods and thanks, walks quickly over to the small room with shelves stacked with canned foods and boxes of macaroni and cheese, and answers her burner. Congressman Mason Conover says,
my latest polling shows we're going to win by at least 10 points next Tuesday. Tell me you've got everything under control.
Williams says,
I've got everything under control.
Good, he says, his voice suddenly sounding cheerful, a tone she's not heard in months. That being the case, Emma, you can start packing your bags in the morning.
He disconnects the call, and Williams needs to lean against the nearby concrete wall for relief. So close, so very, very close. She jumps as her burner phone rings again.
Yes?
You know who this is,
comes another familiar male voice.
I do, she says. How did it go?
We did what you asked us to do, but there's...
Her sense of relief flashes away, like a sliver of ice dropped on the sidewalk in the middle of August.
What happened? What went wrong?
Sheriff, like I said, we did what you asked us to, but there was more shooting. Seems like Dee Dee was talking to this woman, and she was armed, and she shot back. My poor nephew, Ricky, he got himself killed.
William says something extraordinarily foul and obscene about the man's nephew, Ricky, and then says,
go on, what else? Well, his cousin Bo, he fired back and he shot that woman in the head. Near enough killed her. And later I found out, damn it, Sheriff, that woman is some sort of agent or investigator with the army.
Williams feels like the concrete block wall she's leaning against is now pushing back at her, threatening to collapse and bury her at this very moment. Her mouth suddenly dry, Williams says,
how long was Dee Dee with her?
I don't know, the man says. It's just that Dee Dee and her were sitting in a booth when Ricky and Bo went in.
But she's alive.
Barely, I guess, he says. Took a round of the head. I tell you, Bo must have been some angry and spooked to miss like that. Not take the top of her head off.
She stands up from the wall.
Then Bo will have a chance to make it right.
What's that, Sheriff?
Williams closes her eyes, concentrates.
The shooting took place outside Savannah. Gunshot wound to the head. Nearest trauma unit is Memorial Health University Medical Center in Savannah. Tell Bo to get over there and finish the job. I can't have any loose ends out there, especially if that bitch wakes up.
Sheriff, and another thing, she says. Your idiot brother. Tell him to be home tonight and all through the morning. I need to talk to him about a job, got it?
A pause from the other end of the line.
I said, got it?
The man's voice changes to a pleading tone.
Sheriff, I don't know if Bo is up to it. I mean, he's good at tuning folks up if they do you wrong. Making a truck delivery down to Mobile or lifting whatever car you might need, but getting into a hospital and...
She takes a step.
You listen to me, you squirmy little peckerwood bastard. Those two nephews of yours, I sent them on a job because you told me they could do it and do it well. And they screwed it up. And that Bo of yours is going to get over to Savannah as quick as he can and he's going to end it. You understand me? I said, do you understand me?
The voice is meek.
Yes, ma'am.
She won't let it go.
Well, just to make it clear, you slimy little toad, I want that woman gone. Got it? I want her out of the picture this afternoon, and I want confirmation. And it better be a firm and complete confirmation, or I'll send you in next time to saw off her goddamn head and give it to me as a trophy. Do you get it now?
Yes, ma'am.
The man replies again, sounding like he's 6 years old and he just peed in the bed.
Good, she says. I didn't work and sweat and bleed to get where I am just to throw it all away because of idiot men like you. Get the job done.
Williams disconnects the call, turns, and is horrified to see two young girls there, maybe 11 or 12, dressed in sweet little pink and yellow dresses. The girl on the left is holding one of her campaign signs, and the one on the right is holding a black marker clenched in her tiny hands.
Sorry you girls had to hear that,
Williams finally says, taking the black marker pen from the one girl and scrawling her name on the poster held by the other.
You'll learn soon enough of what I was talking about. How important it is not to depend on man.
Chapter 76. Special Agent Manuel Sanchez is speeding east on Interstate 16, about 15 minutes outside Savannah, when he glances up at the rearview mirror and sees a dark blue police cruiser right on his tail, blue lights flashing. Sanchez looks at his speedometer. 102 miles per hour. It'll be hard to talk his way out of this one, but he's going to try. He switches on the Ford's directional and slowly pulls over to the side, where there is nothing around save for tall pines and flat swampy areas, while recalling the text he got a few minutes ago from Pierce, back at Sullivan. York in crit condition, ICU, Memorial Health University Medical Center, Savannah. A thought comes to him. If he's lucky and can spin a good tale, maybe this trooper will let him go. Hell, almost everyone down here is a huge supporter of the military. Say the right word, Sanchez thinks, and maybe the trooper back there will give him a police escort to the hospital, shave off some of the desperate minutes left in his travel time. The cruiser pulls to the side as well, comes up to him, and in Sanchez's rearview mirror, he spots that it's from the Georgia State Patrol. The cruiser sits there and Sanchez taps his fingers on the steering wheel, impatient for the process to start. From the glove box, he pulls out the rental agreement and takes his driver's license out of his wallet. The door to the cruiser opens up. A heavy-set African-American woman steps out, putting on her gray campaign-style hat, and starts walking in his direction. She has on a light blue uniform shirt and gray trousers with a black stripe down the side. Sanchez lowers the window. Switches off the engine. She maintains a distance behind him and says,
Are you sick, sir? Is there an emergency?
I'm fine, he says. But there is an emergency. I'm trying to get to Memorial Health in Savannah as fast as I can.
I see, she says. Family member?
No, ma'am, he says. My coworker. I'm a special agent with the U.S. Army. She's been shot. The woman bends over a bit.
May I see your license and registration?
He passes over his California driver's license and rental agreement. I don't have a registration. This vehicle is a rental.
Uh-huh,
the officer says. She seems to take her time examining his license and the rental agreement. Minutes seem to drag as traffic roars by, the occasional tractor trailer buffeting the Ford. What's taking her so long?
Mr. Sanchez, you say you're a special agent with the U.S. Army?
That's right, he says. Hold on, I'll show you my identification. He opens his leather wallet with the badge and identification and she gives it a quick glance. Her eyes seem to darken and she bites her lower lip.
Well, I'll be, she says. You sure are an agent then, a special agent.
Sanchez takes back his identification and says, Yes, ma'am, and please, would you consider giving me an escort to Memorial Health?
I clocked you going at 100 miles an hour, Mr. Sanchez. You think I could do better?
His hands squeeze the steering wheel.
Ma'am, I... That group in the Army, she says. Known as CIS or something, right?
United States Army Criminal Investigation Division, he says, trying very hard not to lose his temper.
Ah, that's right, she says, smiling. I remember now. You see, my boy Troy, he was an E-4 in the Army, in the 173rd Airborne, stationed over there in Italy. He had a nice Italian girlfriend, but she kept it on the down low, and when her entire family found out that their blonde princess was dating an American black fella, they freaked. Got the locals to arrest him for rape, and the Army was supposed to protect him, and you know what happened?
Sanchez grits his teeth. Ma'am, I'm quite sorry for what happened to your son, but her voice is louder.
That Army CID over there in Italy and the rest of the Army, they made the rape case go away by forcing my Troy out of the Army. That's what happened.
Ma'am, I...
You hold your ass right in place till I check you out.
She turns around and goes back to her cruiser, the blue lights on the roof's light bar still flashing. The officer seems to take her time getting back into the cruiser. Shit, he thinks. He's done this before, back on the job in L.A., showing a suspect or a driver or a pain-in-the-ass civilian who's really in charge. Now it's the trooper's turn. Shit, he thinks again. And, all right, suppose she checks through the GCIC system here, looking at his driver's license status. Everything is fine, no outstanding warrants or violations, of course, but suppose Colonel Broderick up at Quantico, could he be so angry at his calls being ignored that he flagged his license? Meaning that trooper could bring him into custody? Sanchez looks back at the cruiser and the traffic. There's an opening behind him, with two tractor-trailer trucks in the distance traveling side by side, heading in his direction. He starts up the Ford's engine, puts the car into drive, and slams the accelerator with his foot, pulling out in front of the approaching trucks.
Chapter 77. 19 minutes later, and after screeching the Ford into a space in the parking lot nearest the main entrance, Sanchez barrels his way through the hospital's complex until he finds the facility's trauma ICU. The place is pleasant-looking enough, with light wood cabinets and white ceilings and soft overhead lights, but Sanchez is in a hurry, not sure how far that Georgia State Patrol officer will go in tracking him down. Entry into the trauma ICU looks to be controlled by a big guy at an exterior reception desk. When he buzzes in to hospital personnel, Sanchez follows them inside. At the nearest nurse's station, he shows his badge, and almost out of breath from running here, he says, Special Agent Manuel Sanchez, U.S. Army CID. You have a CID agent here, Connie York. Where is she? The male nurse is in light blue scrubs and looks at him with suspicion. After staring at his badge and identification, he says, She's in trauma room too, but I don't think visitors- Thanks, Sanchez says, moving on. The place is quiet, but nurses and doctors bustle around him, and down the hallway is a series of sliding glass doors with handles. The nurse yells out, Hey! But Sanchez ignores him. There, room two. He slides the door open, surprising two nurses, one male, the other female, at their work. The woman says,
Excuse me, who are you?
He shows his badge and identification. I am Special Agent Manuel Sanchez, Army CID. How is she? The male nurse slips out, and the woman says,
Have you registered up front?
No, he says.
You need to.
Sanchez snaps, How is she, damn it?
critical, she says.
Look, you need to—
Ma'am, all due respect, you can get the hell out. I'm not going anywhere. She leaves and Sanchez steps forward, thinking there's been a mistake. A serious mistake, because that's not Connie in that bed, hooked up to IV tubes, wires, and other sensors. The poor woman there is heavily bandaged about her head, the head mostly shaved, and she's breathing through a tube stuck down her throat. Her eyes are swollen and her cheeks are puffed out. It can't be Connie. Can't. But there's a whiteboard near her bed, and sure enough, in careful block lettering above her vital signs and the names of the doctors and nurses taking care of her, it states, Constance York. The door slides open. He turns. A large man is there, dark hair, wearing black trousers, black sneakers, and a black vest over a light blue shirt, the vest with bright yellow letters saying, Security. Sanchez looks him over, notes the handcuffs, the expandable baton, and another weapon with a bright yellow handle denoting a taser.
Sir, you need to leave,
the man says. I want to see this woman's doctor. He shakes his head.
You can do that outside once you register up front at the nurse's station.
I don't. The security officer takes two steps forward.
Sir, I know you're upset and you're concerned, but with the way you came in here, the staff and nurses, they're also upset and concerned. Please be a gentleman, all right? I bet you'll be able to come back in just a few minutes. Please don't make me escalate things, all right?
Sanchez knows what he means by escalating. Maybe a quick shot from the taser and then cuffing him on the floor. Then Sanchez will be out of action, and how will that help things? All right, he says. I'll leave. The security guard smiles, slides the door open. Thanks so much, sir. You won't regret it. When the army guy leaves, Bo Layton can't believe how much his luck is changing after that disastrous shootout at the Waffle House a few hours ago. But God must be riding shotgun, because after getting a good remount from his uncle about how he and Ricky screwed up the job, his uncle offered him redemption. And look here, his second cousin Derek, the son of a bitch, actually worked security here at this hospital, and his uniform actually fit, and like most places, if you look as if you belong, you get left alone. Then his luck really kicked in when he got up to this trauma ICU unit and found out that this army agent was making a fuss in the bitch's room, so that gave him the perfect excuse to casually walk down here and kick the guy out. But no time to press his luck. There's a chair next to the big bed with the wounded agent. Christ, how the hell was she alive with a .45 jacketed round hitting her head? And all those wires and tubes. And in the chair is a nice white pillow. Bo walks over, picks up the pillow. Just a few seconds and then it'll be right. And his cousin won't have died in vain. Bitch. Chapter 78. As his fellow squad mate Pierce makes the turn into the crowded parking lot of the Ralston Police Station and jail, Lieutenant John Huang reaches a decision. Once this horror show of a case is settled, one way or another, he's putting in his papers and resigning from the army. Because deep down, he's just a psychiatrist, a head doctor, a shrink. Despite what the army thinks, and especially despite the uncomfortable feeling of the 9mm Sig Sauer digging into his waist, he's not a soldier. He's just a doc, and since he's been here in Georgia, a lousy doc at that, with the bloody suicide of an army ranger on his hands and conscience. His companion, Captain Alan Pierce, whistles and says, John, I don't see an empty space here, damn it.
Then park illegally, Huang replies, over there by those picnic tables. If we're fortunate, the cops here will be too busy to ticket us.
Pierce smiles, but Huang is not in a joking mood. The lot is filled with cars, news vans, and satellite trucks, all waiting for word from within the jail where the three surviving ranger prisoners are being held. They both get out of the car, and Pierce says, John, just to give you a heads up, I intend to sling a lot of legal bullshit in there.
What kind? Huang asks.
The kind I'm currently making up, Pierce says. All I ask is that you roll with me. Give me backup. Huang wants to argue the point, but gives up. Why get the army lawyer all spun up now? When this investigation is finished, poor Pierce will probably end up getting disbarred anyway.
Sure, Alan, he says. I'll do that.
A few minutes later, they are in the same reception area as before, with an angry Chief Richard Kane staring at them both.
What?
he says.
You say you're going to do what?
Huang is impressed at how calm and professional Pierce is, facing down the police chief with nothing to back him up but his lawyer's tongue. Like I said, chief, Pierce says, standing straight and firm. I intend to spend the night here with Dr. Huang to ensure nothing happens to the three army personnel before tomorrow's court hearing. We don't have to be in their cells or near their cells, but we will remain here, keeping track of jail staff and any visitors they may receive. The chief explodes with a series of obscenities and finally says,
What the hell gives you the right? You think I'm running a goddamn Motel 6 here or something? Why should I allow you two to stay here without a warrant?
Huang admires Pierce for not giving an inch. At this moment, chief, a team from the FBI's Civil Rights Unit is en route to investigate you, this facility, and your personnel.
Civil rights? What the hell are you talking about?
Pierce gives the angry chief a tight smile. Specialist Vinny Tyler, the ranger who allegedly killed himself in his cell? Have you forgotten him? We certainly haven't, and neither has the Army. Among any other crimes you and your department may have committed, you most definitely violated the specialist's civil rights. Huang sees exhaustion, anger, and confusion in the chief's eyes. It's his turn. Huang says,
In my professional opinion, Chief Kane, you and your personnel offered a hostile environment that adversely affected Specialist Tyler's health. That means you and everyone else here is criminally liable.
You!
Pierce jumps right back in. But with us staying here, keeping watch and recording everyone coming in and out, ensuring nothing untoward happens to the three surviving Rangers, that may help mitigate the situation once the FBI arrives. It will put them in a better frame of mind. Huang sees the chief's head moving, looking at the JAG lawyer and then at him. Huang imagines what the chief is thinking. An arrest made in a major crime case involving multiple homicides should have been a wonderful publicity coup for a small town like this. Increased media attention, well-dones from his fellow cops, even the local mayor and council in a mood to increase the department's budget next year. Huang knows what the quick glance means from the chief. He's looking for a way out.
Huang says, Chief, I know this is an intrusion, and you've got a lot going on with all that news media out there, and with the FBI arriving.
Tomorrow, Pierce says. The FBI will be here tomorrow.
But we won't disturb you or your staff, Huang goes on. We'll stay here in the reception area. We won't bother or interact with anyone. We'll just sit in place.
The chief's eyes are still glaring at them with anger, but Huang senses the man is giving up.
All right, he says, stepping back. You two, you sit out here. You don't move except if you've got to take a piss. And you're on your own. Don't expect food, water, or a blanket, got it?
Pierce moves to a nearby orange plastic chair.
Got it, chief.
The chief opens the door leading to the department's offices, making sure to slam it good and hard. Huang sits down next to Pierce.
Good job, he says to Pierce.
Pierce just nods, then points to a sign over the doorway leading into the jail. All conversations subject to audio and video recording. Huang nods in return, getting the message. Then Pierce shifts in his chair, pulling out his 9mm Sig Sauer pistol, and slides it between his right leg and the chair. Huang gets that message as well.
Chapter 79. Special Agent Manuel Sanchez is walking to the nurse's station at the entrance to the trauma ICU when he stops and quickly looks back. The security guard who chased him out of York's room is still in there. Why? Bo Layton spent a summer years back working as a volunteer EMT firefighter for Sullivan County.